In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band that called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the law. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We've come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We've come to work the land in common and to make the wastelands grow. This earth divided, we will make whole, so it can be a common treasury.
And welcome to Here We Stand. Welcome back. It's February 2nd, 2019, believe it or not. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. Welcome. We've been off the air, of course, for a couple of months, but very active, restructuring our network. And we're going to be talking about that today in upcoming shows. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Greenwich time. And I want to start with, first of all, a welcome to all of the new listeners, because we know there's many of you who have been, of the tens of thousands who have been plugging into our work over the last little while because of the very important news coming out of Rome. And also to the old listeners, the old guard, are good people who've been hanging in with us for over 5 years now. And I want to start with a quote from my ancestor, Peter Annett, who was stuck in the public stocks in London in 1761 for writing something called The Free Inquirer, which challenged the autocracy of the Crown of England and the Anglican Church. And he said, "We shall expose the hidden works of darkness and drive falsity to the bottomless pit." Well, of course, you know, words don't do anything by themselves unless they're a precursor to action, a springboard to action. And that's what we do on this program. We not only inform, we inspire, we train, we arm you, and we mobilize you to take down the systems of oppression using the common law. Today, I'm going to first of all give a summary of some of the news items, and then we're going to hear some voices, people who have pulled back the lies of the genocide, starting in Canada, where this crime for me began, but now spreading all over the world. First of all, some of you might have been following on our website, itccs.org, before it was taken down, and a short note on that, it is in the process of being restructured, and hopefully this week we'll be back online. But one of the things that caused it being taken down was a very important news item came out on January 12th, and that is that the present Pope Jorge Bergoglio, a.k.a. Pope Francis, will likely be removed from office by a palace coup before February 23rd, 24th, because that, of course, is the weekend of a conclave of the Ninth Circle, the satanic ritual cult that he is an integral part of. It wants him out of office before that conclave in Rome at the San Lorenzo Jesuit Church in Rome, because Bergoglio is simply bringing too much heat to bear on the Vatican. We have this from inside sources in the Vatican. An example of that is over half the bishops who were summoned by Bergoglio to come to Rome early in January to kind of bolster up his position, over half of them didn't even turn up, which is a first in Vatican history for bishops to simply ignore a serving pope, so-called pope, and that's, of course, because they know his days are numbered. Now, there's different speculations on what's going on, but, of course, who is the figurehead doesn't matter so much as the beast itself. No matter who they bring in to replace him, the same institution of child killing and genocide carries on. So we are beginning, and I want to announce this for listeners all over the world, there is a special campaign that the ITCCS in Europe and North America is launching. It'll go between February 23rd and Easter Sunday, April the 21st, a two-month, eight-week period. And during that time, we're ramping up the direct actions against the Church of Rome and its subsidiaries like the Church of England, the United Church of Canada, that is being a partner in its crimes, and so on. For one thing, nullifying the tax exemptions and immunities of the church is a big move targeting certain sympathetic officials in state who are going to be pressing to have the tax exemptions of the Catholic Church nullified. Now, there's direct action you can take to make sure that happens on the ground. We prepared a special leaflet that Catholics are to fill out and drop in the collection plate. It basically says as long as you follow these policies of protecting child rapists, like the policy of crimen solicitanus that you can see online at murderbydecree.com, as long as you follow these policies, we're not giving you any more money. Drop that in the collection plate. It is already causing quite a stir all over the world. I've had several dozen requests for a copy of this leaflet from Europe and North America. We've already heard back from sympathetic priests and a few bishops in Europe that, yes, it's getting the church very upset because, of course, they are a big money-sucking corporation, and they don't want their tax exemptions nullified or the people stopping funding them. So this is a very important Achilles heel they have. We urge people to write to us, itccsoffice@gmail.com, or thecommonland@gmail.com. We'll send you a copy of that. Also, of course, part of this campaign will be the arrest of convicted killers within the church, people who are stand under common law arrest warrants. And they, again, there's been several attempts to arrest Bergoglio, as you know, if you followed our work. These further attempts, it will include reclamations of church property. The Catholic, Anglican, United Churches in Canada, for example, their property are actually now, under this common law warrant, are now the property of the people and can be seized lawfully at any time because they're genocidal institutions. So that is an important campaign to keep aware of. And in the coming weeks, we're going to be having people on the air, including from the Common Law Assembly in Dublin, Ireland, and other places in Europe that will be leading this campaign. So please tune in for that. Also, in the coming shows, this month is the 25th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico. And we're going to be having participants in that from that movement on the air talking about what self-governance means for the indigenous people of Chiapas and the lessons we can learn from them. Those are some of the other shows. Also today I was tuned in with a woman, very important woman, called Catherine Horton. She's a doctor in Europe who's leading the campaign to expose targeted individuals and energy weaponry. And she's got a whole campaign to expose this in the courts, and we're going to be having her on the show and actually helping her convene a common law court case in Europe to expose targeted energy weapons. And the other thing I want to mention, too, leading into some of the things we're going to hear today on the air, there are common law assemblies forming in Sacramento, California, Dublin, Toronto, and now even Vancouver, to bring out these crimes, to mobilize the citizenry on the ground. One of the things that's happening on the West Coast is very important, and it's related to some of the clips you're going to hear today on the air. For the last year, there's been a West Coast common law grand jury operating to gather the evidence of not only the crimes in the past that we know so well, that's documented at murderbydecree.com, the crimes against indigenous children, but how those crimes have spread, the ongoing child trafficking, the involvement of the Chinese government in organ trafficking, the disappearances of entire Native families throughout the northern British Columbia region. This is being documented thoroughly by the grand jury. And two important aspects of that is the murder of eyewitnesses and the actual spin doctoring going on by church and state and corporations in Canada to cover that up. And we're going to be hearing two of those clips that I'll introduce soon about that. But also to remind folks, if you really want to, and if you're a new listener especially, and you want to be kept informed about all of this, go to Amazon.com and put in my name, Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. You'll see all of our books, including several recent ones, The Manual to Train People on the Common Law, The Whistleblower Manual of How to Fight Back, At the Mouth of a Cannon, which is my recent book, explaining how the corporations, churches, and government continually conspire together and still do this so, in grabbing the land and destroying people's lives. And, of course, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, one of the best-selling books we have, which has the hard evidence. Now, you know, the old saying, evil has an address. We don't talk in general about evil on this show. We give the address. We name the names. And we've done that and continue to do that. It's probably one of the reasons there's now yet another cease and desist order against me from two of the perpetrators of those crimes, a couple of United Church clergy on Vancouver Island called Phil Spencer and Foster Freed, who are implicated in this 12 Mile Club, the offshore-based network of child trafficking and child murder that goes on, that our work inadvertently exposed. And, you know, this is the kind of reaction you get when you get close to that evil with an address. So please tune in for coming shows about that. Follow the work, murderbydecree.com, and also write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com, for more of this information. Now, just a preview of the first clip we're going to play today. That clip is actually two Native people talking. It's exposing Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which, of course, this TRC was an eight-year project by government and churches to cover up their own crimes under the guise of an inquiry. Now, I often say this is like the serial killer appointing his own judge and jury. The government and churches of Canada appoint an investigation to look into the residential schools that they set up and ran. Of course, the whole thing was a farce. They gagged the eyewitnesses, and ran it in a completely self-serving way. Well, there's two eyewitnesses to that who are going to be talking to us now. Shauna Green, a young Native woman from Alberta, and Sylvester Green, they're of no relation, but both from Alberta. And they're going to be talking about their experience of these TRC hearings, where the names were not allowed to be taken down as evidence, the names of perpetrators. People were gagged. Their statements were looked over first by these government and church-appointed commissioners. It was a complete farce. And they're going to describe the details of that. So this is a very important thing to understand of how and why these cover-ups continue to happen and how the cover-up is a continuing part of the crime. Just as serious under the law is the cover-up as is the original crime. So we're going to hear this now. We'll be back after that for more commentary on the next thing you'll be hearing. But please listen to these two eyewitnesses. Thank you.
My name is Shauna Green. I am from Samson Cree Nation, which is in Hobima, Alberta. I've been living in British Columbia since I was 17 years old. I'm 33 now. And I attended the TRC conference in Victoria in April of 2012. And I was quite disturbed by a lot of the things that I saw. First of all, I was disturbed by the amount of money that was spent on the whole event. It was put on at the Empress Hotel. There was literature. I don't know how many pieces of paper I got, pens, little pins, whole bunch of stuff. I just couldn't believe how much money was spent on a show. The minute I got there, I just knew that this was a great big show to bury what really went on with the government and the churches involved. The first day I went was the Friday. Where they had a big celebration at night. I went as a drummer, and I attended the night ceremony. What put me off and what put a lot of people off is that BC Hydro did a great big presentation. And they did this screen show first on a big screen, and they showed only the happy pictures of residential school. They didn't show the pictures of, you know, all the kids that had tuberculosis put together in the same room as healthy children. They didn't show those pictures. They didn't show of the children that had no teeth and the children that had their hair cut off that were crying. They just showed these happy pictures of children in clean uniforms and smiling. I could not understand the first night why Shaw Cable put on a presentation and why BC Hydro was there. It made no sense. But once learning about things from Unrepentant, it made sense. It proved to me that really there's these big corporations that are making money, they are still working together with the churches, or big companies like that wouldn't care and they wouldn't be there. So that was my first impression of Friday. And I had decided that I wanted to do my own statement, so I was determined to get up. The next morning I got up really early and I made sure that I was in Victoria, because I live about 40 minutes away from Victoria. I was determined to go and give my statement. And so I had it arrived just in time, but they had told me that they already had their public speakers chosen. And I had found out the guidelines for the being chosen. You have to, they ask you what you're going to say. Basically, they want to know what you're going to go up there and say. And then they must go from a list and pick, okay, you're safe, you're safe, you're safe. And then they let those people speak. So I definitely was not... I for one was too late, or they just simply saw my intent and decided they didn't want to have me up there publicly speaking to people. So I gave my private statement. The only question that they did ask, or the only legal thing that they did tell me, was that two legal things is that they could use my audio recording anywhere they wanted, whenever they wanted, and that the only thing they really did seem to care about is if I said that I was going to harm myself, or if my child was being harmed, they had to report that. But nothing about, like, you know, if there were crimes committed, they were going to help you fix it, or if you knew of crimes being committed, they were going to help you. Like, there was nothing, anything like that. It was a great big show. There was another impression to me that the money that was given to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was spent on a show. It's a big show. So I gave my statement anyways. I did it in a way just because I wanted to heal a little bit, and I just wanted the experience so I could talk about it. And so I did my thing, and then I still was determined to go and give my statement, which I did later out in the public. But that morning we went to the big hall, and I think it was the main room for the TRC, and I walked in right when the one of the bishops, a couple bishops were there, Archbishop was there, and some priests from the Anglican Church, the United Church, and a Presbyterian church, I'm sure. I wish I would have gotten the names of who was speaking and where they were from, but all I know is that I walked into a room of lies and a room of people covering up their, I don't know, I walked into, like, it just felt like a big theater, like the feeling in the room, like that they were going to crucify someone. It was awful in there. The first person that I heard speaking was a priest, and I'm not sure where he was from, but he basically told, he was talking about how, like, I can't believe he got the gall to get up to the mic and say, "We took away your children," and he's saying this to a whole bunch of Native residential school survivors. He told them, we took your children away from you because we didn't feel that you could take care of them. We thought that we could give them a better life. And at that point, which I thought was the highlight of the TRC, was when the survivors started yelling, "Liar! Liar! Tell the truth!" Because he wasn't telling the truth. And you could hear it in his voice that he was lying. What bothered me even more is that all these archbishops and these bishops and these priests all got front row, like movie stars. And all the, like, you know, the residential school people should have been in the front row. It was awesome. It was probably like 10 minutes in those people's lives where they felt, I get to stand up for what happened to me. And then big old Justice Murray Sinclair stands up in his $700 shirt, paid for by Canadians' taxes, I'm sure. He gets up and tells them that they have to give respect to the bishops and the priests there, that they have to give them the respect and let them say what they want. You know, and I couldn't believe that, you know, you couldn't even let those people go on for a little while and talk about, you know, this event is supposed to be for them, but they have to be quiet. That's what I don't understand. So after Murray Sinclair sat down and everyone did become silent, they did respect what he said. This woman who was saying, "Liar, liar," trying to stand up for herself, she just broke down in tears and wailed like someone had just died. Probably part of her heart just broke because she probably felt she had the chance to stand up for herself and then was crushed by very one of her own people. So more archbishops and priests got up and talked about how they thought they were doing the right thing and how that I don't recall sorry ever being said. I recall just this attitude, like, they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that there was no responsibility. White people could just talk forever, but it seemed like when the Native people talked that they had, like, there was always, like, a worker or one of the TRC workers by them, and it was to watch that they didn't say anything that would jeopardize this whole, you know, like, that would embarrass the situation. And the same thing happened to me. Like, I was definitely watched. The Friday of the night before, I just wanted to take a picture of all the different things, the funding of who was funding the TRC. And I didn't have a piece of paper, so I was just taking pictures.
Could you list who funded the TRC?
Yeah, it was Shaw Cable, BC Hydro, the United Church, the Anglican Church of Canada, and the Presbyterian churches, all funded. And these are the very people that, and of course the Government of Canada, these are the very people that put people in residential school, the very people that created all this chaos for the Native people, and then have the gall to say, "We were just trying to help you." I had all these copies burned of Unrepentant, because I think every Canadian should probably see Unrepentant. because it's the truth. It's the truth of what happened in Canada. And I, first of all, tried to have it played through my job. I tried to have it played at the filming. They're going to have some screenings about residential school. And I had Unrepentant on the list, and it sounded like we were going to have it played. And then, like, 2 days before it happened, it got pulled, which I kind of thought would happen. I was hoping it wouldn't, but it did. And then I ended up not being able to do what I was going to do. And then so I just burned my own copies, brought them there on Saturday. And I was just kind of, I went up to the media and tried to get them to take one. And she wouldn't take one. As soon as I said Kevin Annette's name, she just, her face changed, her body language changed. And I just asked her if she would even watch it, and she just said, no, probably not. And I was, so I took back my Unrepentant DVD, and it just seemed like a lot of people didn't want me to show it. And the TRC did not want it played there. And I asked, she was an assistant to one of the commissioners, and I asked her why she wouldn't play Unrepentant. And I already knew the answer, but I said it to her, and she just scoffed at me. She just went, oh, like, you silly Native girl. Like, it was insane, the reaction to this film. And that's how I knew that this whole TRC thing is just it's a big show. It's just a big fakery. It's like these people met in a room, these bad people, they met in a room, and they decided, you know, let's have a big show to make it look like we're helping them. In reality, they knew that the TRC would bring out these hearings, that it would bring out emotions and post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide. They knew that. It's part of this Native killing machine. Because if these people truly wanted to help people and wanted things to change, they would have let me handle Unrepentant. They would have played Unrepentant, because they wouldn't be afraid. But that's how afraid people are of the truth. And that's why Unrepentant wasn't played at the TRC, because it is the most honest thing about what happened. And because all those people who are involved, the Anglican Church, the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, of course, Protestant Church, all these people with the government, and now bigger companies like BC Hydro, Shaw Cable, like, these are energy companies. Like, they're all working together. It's all business, and they're using religion and politics to blind people when they're just big, fat businessmen, or business ladies, businessmen. They don't give a crap about people. They don't give a crap about taxpayers. You know, the Indians are the best excuse, or the best scapegoat, you know, politicians and church people will ever have. And that's why we need to stand up and not take it anymore.
My name is Sylvester Green, and I live here in Vancouver. I've been here for 21 years, and originally from Hazleton, BC, and I went to Edmonton residential school for 10 years. And this year, March 2nd, for 3 days there, they had Truth and Reconciliation Forum. And different people from around the world came. I didn't really care about the TRC forum, because there was no chance for us survivors to speak, and I was very disappointed to them. In what was going on there. They said for us not to mention any names of the perpetrators. But I said on those two cameras in front of everybody in the circle there, I said, this is all bullshit. I said, here's the names of the people that abused me, three white assholes that abused me in Edmonton. I said, Jim Ludford and Mr. Moore and McCathern, Burns McCathern. I said, these bastards, they're the ones that abused me when I was a little kid. And
when you spoke, it wasn't at the TRC, it was in the healing circle, was it?
It was in the talking circle.
So in the TRC forum, they didn't let survivors speak?
No, we weren't allowed to, not allowed. They had mics there, but never had an open mic for us survivors to speak.
How many survivors would you say were there?
From what I remember, all I could think of was about 10 survivors there. And that was all. And none of the survivors got up and spoke.
Shauna Green, Sylvester Green, eyewitnesses to the farce. Now, I wanted to clarify or fill in a little bit of what Shauna especially was saying. She kept referring to Unrepentant, the documentary film. Now, for those of you who know or don't know, that was an original film that we did, and it documenting the crimes in the residential schools. And it went ballistic in 2007. It really was one of the things that forced the apology in 2008. There was like 500,000 hits on our film that we released over the Internet. And I remember Gary Morasty, a member of Parliament, watched that film. He got up the next week in Parliament and asked the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, when were the children going to be brought home for a proper burial? So it shows you the power of documenting this. And yet, as Shauna described, that film was banned from the TRC forum, as she was, which she didn't mention, too, is that she was then asked to leave altogether from the forum after trying to get that in. She also mentioned how the witnesses who tried to speak at the mic were not only restricted in what they could say, but they had people watching them, unlike the church people who got up to speak. Now, these watchers, we've heard about this all over. Whenever anyone gets up to speak at these public events, there's somebody at their elbow, either from the government or somebody they know who's being paid to intimidate them. The same thing happened when we held our first independent tribunal into residential school crimes in June 1998 in Vancouver. The UN group that we brought in, IRAM, sent 10 observers. And I remember there, because I helped set up the thing, was held in the Maritime Labor Center in the east side of Vancouver. And this guy showed up. He was a very large Aboriginal guy called Dean Wilson. And I know for a fact what he was up to, because that night he had me by the throat. He forced me into a corner and said, Eddie John says, if you keep talking about murder residential school children, you're going to end up dead, unquote. That's what Dean Wilson said to me as he had me by the throat. Well, Ed John was the federal native puppet politician who owns, he's a shareholder in BC Hydro, that as one of the big land-grabbing companies that Shauna mentioned, that had sponsored this TRC event. Well, Dean Wilson sat right next to any of the witnesses whenever they spoke, and we didn't know what was going on until we finally mentioned it and they tried to get him to leave and he wouldn't. But he would literally sit next to them, and half the people who saw him literally got up and left the room because they knew that he's an old-time United Church goon up in the northern parts of BC. He's been involved in the disappearances of Native people himself. He's part of the whole criminal network up there. So this is what they do at these forums under the guise of, you know, wanting to hear from the survivors. So the important thing about all this is that the cover-up now is part of the crime, because it isn't simply covering up crimes of the past so as not to embarrass people today and cost the church money. That's just the window dressing. It's to cover up ongoing crimes, because the murder of children years ago in residential schools, it's ongoing. We know, we've documented how the child trafficking all over the coast continues, and this happens all over the world, but we're focusing very much on the West Coast in this grand jury investigation because it's where we have the best evidence right now. And in many ways, it served as the template for other crimes elsewhere. These crimes are ongoing. there's talk the Trudeau government set up this phony missing women's inquiry. What they're not mentioning is as early as 2003, we had our own community task force into missing people in Vancouver. And George Brown, an Aboriginal RCMP constable, told me that in the early police reports, in the bodies of the Native women that were found, some of their organs were missing. And that was swabbed out of the media reports and the subsequent police and corp reports. But they were missing eyes, lungs, hearts, kidneys. And it turns out that in the areas in northern BC where these a lot of the Native families are going missing, they're very close to the liquid natural gas developments that are pretty much run by Chinese cartels. Well, one of these guys who runs it is the general, one of the generals who owns the prisons in China where they do the organ trafficking, where a lot of the Falun Gong and other political dissidents go missing and get killed every year, so their organs can be trafficked. That's been well documented. Well, the same guy is in BC buying up the liquid natural gas, and it's the same areas where a lot of these disappearances are happening. So, you know, obviously there's a link there, and that's why they want to cover up the past, because it'll lead directly to the present day and these ongoing crimes. Well, in that regard, the second clip we're going to hear from, it's an interview I did with a nurse who worked at St. Paul's Hospital, who was witness to the killing of William Coombs. William Coombs was an eyewitness to the abduction of 10 children by Queen Elizabeth at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in October 1964, 10 children who vanished and were never seen again. William was to come to London in February 2011 to give testimony, but then he was summoned to St. Paul's Hospital. He died. As it turns out, according to this nurse who goes by the name, I forget the name she was named, well, you hear it, but it's a pseudonym she had to use because she had to go into hiding after. And she described how all of the evidence that she saw when she was treating William in his last few days alive indicated that he was, in fact, poisoned. He didn't die of tuberculosis. He had no symptoms of tuberculosis, as the death certificate claims, but she thinks it was arsenic poisoning, and she'll describe that in this next clip. And after that, we'll be back to give some other announcements and looking ahead to the coming shows. But I really need you to hear this interview with the nurse who treated William Coombs, one of the members of our network, the ITCC network in Vancouver. He took part in protests. He named Queen Elizabeth as an abductor of children. He was killed in St. Paul's Hospital just before giving public testimony about that in London, England. Here's the interview.
I'm here with Erica, a former nurse at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, and we're talking about William Arnold Coombs, who died in February 2011, and you were part of the treatment of William. At the time, I guess you didn't know that he had been an eyewitness to the abduction of 10 children by Queen Elizabeth from a residential school in October 1964, and he had gone public and talked about that, and he was on the verge of being invited over to England when he died. And so we want to talk a little bit about your experience with William.
No, I wasn't aware of that, but I knew there was something out when I arrived for these constant care shifts, which is basically one-on-one LPN to one patient, which is usually only done if there's like very specific needs with that person. I found out when I arrived that when the CNL came up, she told me that they are identity protected, so I knew that there was something up immediately. The name on the chart was Ernie Coombs, which kind of made me laugh because that's Mr. Dressup's name. But
it was also the name of his dead brother who died in a residential school.
Yeah, that's what you told me when I first spoke with you, and that's kind of very mean. Me to have us call him that. Anyways, so I read the chart and it said basically the diagnosis was undiagnosed bloodborne infection and ETOH, which is alcoholism. And I went in the room after seeing that he only had one med prescribed to him. That was furosemide or Lasix, which is a fluid shifting med, usually for edema. And went in the room, and he had not eaten his dinner, and I asked him if he was hungry, and he said he had a stomach ache. And then sort of tidied things up in the room, and I watched him get up to go to the bathroom, and his
mobility was extremely unstable. I asked him if he was dizzy, and he didn't say anything then. But later on, when he called for me for help getting up from the bathroom, he said the room was spinning, so I knew he was having vertigo and extreme weakness. He couldn't even get up. It was at that time that I saw his skin pallor wasn't right. It was mottled and had raised bumps, something you'd call hyperkeratosis. He wasn't coughing at all. His urine was dark and smelly, which indicates that there's some sort of toxin in his system.
Was there any
stressed kidneys?
Any indication? They claim his cause of death was disseminated tuberculosis. Was there any indication of tuberculosis when you saw him?
None whatsoever. Like I said, he wasn't coughing and there was no fever, and his chest sounds were clear when I did the head to toe. There was absolutely no sputum, evidence of sputum, anything, spinal towels. Sometimes they'll hide it like that, and there was nothing like that. There was nothing in the charts of any previous nurses that had seen any blood in his sputum, which is what you cough up, and any evidence of crepitus in the lungs. That would be like blockage. That's part of the meningitis kind of balls that form and block up the lungs when someone has active TB. Did not have active TB. I did, when I was in the bathroom with him, that's when I saw a Band-Aid on his lower back, and this Band-Aid is exactly where you would have a plaster put on after an LP. And LP is a common test for TB.
LP is lumbar puncture?
Yeah. Beyond that little, the skin scratch test, the Manitou test. He didn't have any marks from that either. That's a little four prongs. Both of these things are really identifiable. And that led me to go and look through, like, the full chart and see if there was any tests for TB or things like that that were called for or even in order for the LP. I did, in that shift, ask the CNO, about his undiagnosed bloodborne infection, why he wasn't on an IV, remarked that his blood pressure was low and that he was dizzy and that perhaps he should be, and why isn't there any broad-spectrum antibiotics being given to him, given the undiagnosed bloodborne infection. He literally had nothing in him. He was obviously very sick feeling. He seemed pretty quiet and depressed, really.
And when he apparently had some toxic poison in his system, he wasn't in isolation of any kind, though.
Yeah, that was the other part. He was in what's called an isolation room. There's two or three of them at the end of every unit in St. Paul's, and they're pretty, like, coveted rooms for, we usually like to spare them for people that are contagious infections. And there was absolutely no contagion protocols in place for myself or any of the other people that came in and or out of that room.
So a lot of anomalies.
Yeah, there was a lot of things that didn't make sense. I did a total of four shifts with him. And the CNO, she would hear me on my questions about why he doesn't have an IV, he's not drinking or eating well, and no antibiotics. She would hear me on it and she'd tell me she'd get back to me, but she didn't, which was unusual for her. She was a long time experienced.
And then tell us about the meeting you were called into.
Yeah, the CNO came up to me and when I was charting at the end of the midway through the shift, not at the end of the shift. And by the end of the shift, I was to go to a meeting regarding Ernie William. And she didn't tell me that much about it. I had assumed it was a family meeting. She did come and knock on the door to tell me when they were ready, and she brought me to the little office, and there was three chairs of three people sitting there, and none of them looked Native, none were family. And I sat down. One woman in the room had a St. Paul's badge. The other two had no badges whatsoever. I had never seen them before. The two men were, middle-aged. One was a Caucasian with very graying hair and a sort of like gaunt pale skin as if he'd been under fluorescent lights way too long. And the other fellow was very northern native BC looking, very Asiatic eyes, big bushy eyebrows, thick, wavy, dark hair with graying on the temples. He stared at me intensely the whole meeting. They asked me very pointed questions that were also very, they didn't fit with a hospital care planning meeting.
Like what questions?
They asked me what he'd been saying. And I had been involved with patients that were under observation for non-consensual admission before, and I think I reacted from fear of, I didn't want to answer this question. I asked them why he didn't have an IV, why he wasn't on antibiotics. That was my response, and that's when the native-looking man just, you know, what's his mental status? He barked out at me, and I didn't like the look of him. He actually kind of scared me. And I said, I don't know. Why don't you have a psych consult come in?
Why do you think he asked about his mental status?
Well, that's... In Canada, you need 3 doctors to sign off on you to basically be non-consensually admitted to a psych unit or have all your rights taken away, have anything done to you medically.
Including have your life support terminated?
If that's what they did, you could do that. Usually that's reserved for people who don't have any family, but yes, they could do that.
Because in William's case, that's exactly what happened later at BGH. They pulled him off life support without anyone's permission.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. The whole thing made me feel like I didn't want a nurse anymore. It felt like we weren't doing our job for this man.
So based on what you saw, some of the other symptoms you saw on him, what do you think, what's your medical opinion about his cause of death?
In hindsight, hyperkeratosis, the dark urine, he had these lines on his nails. They weren't ridged. It looked like the moon of your nail bed went halfway up, and it was a slightly darker singular line right across. Those lines combined with the constant abdominal pains, the dizziness, and moments of almost delirium that I saw him have. He you know, around the twilight hour, 6 to 7 o'clock, he would almost be talking about, like, memories as if they were currently happening in the room. And I let him go with it because, you know, he's talking to me.
The delirious. What does that all indicate?
And these lines, which are called Mies lines, indicate arsenic poisoning. Specifically in combination with the hyperkeratosis, the papules I saw on his skin that at first looked like scratches, but when I looked closer, they were just little bumps.
So in your opinion, is that what he died of?
It could very well be. Undiagnosed bloodborne infection doesn't manifest as Mies lines, and he had no fever. And
no TB.
And no TB. And
even though
being tested for it, and no antibiotics.
Let me just hand you this. That's the official coroner's report, and it says that he died of disseminated tuberculosis. It doesn't mention that they pulled him off life support.
Tuberculosis is disseminated throughout the blood. Given the widespread nature of the disease, it is unlikely that any head injuries would have caused or contributed to the spread of the disease into the brain. So it was in his brain. Well, this is interesting because they're saying it's throughout his bloodstream. But this doesn't make any sense. Toxicological testing was not necessary. Well, that would have shown what the Mies lines was showing.
So you disagree with the coroner's report?
Oh, absolutely.
Any final thoughts about any of this?
Postmortem cultures confirmed antemortem diagnosis of TB. We got a lot of TB in medicine, and we knew when there was a TB in the room, whether or not it was active or passive, because there is several different types of TB. there's no way that if they suspected this,
yeah,
but they did, right? Because it was a bloodborne infection. Yeah.
Could you turn to the front to the picture of William and just hold that up? And that's the man you treated?
Yeah, that is definitely the man I treated. That bandana was even in the room.
Thanks, Eric, sir.
And we're back. Erica Kelly, that's a pseudonym. An interview from October 14th, 2017. Now, I have in front of me the coroner's report for William Arnold Coombs, case number 2011-0372-0013, Ministry of Public Safety and Solicitor General for the Province of British Columbia. Investigative findings, as Erica just described, right at the end, I find that William Arnold Coombs died on February 26, 2011 of disseminated tuberculosis. I classify this death as natural and make no recommendations. Toxicological testing was not necessary or required to determine cause of death. Signed, Claire Thompson, coroner for the Province of British Columbia. Well, that's a criminal act there. It's a lie because, according to Erica herself, doesn't bear at all any resemblance to his actual condition. Now, this is not unusual. I should tell you folks, St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, Catholic-run hospital, traditionally, it's the spot where, according to eyewitnesses, they were taken for sterilization back in the 40s and 50s and 60s when they were in the Squamish, the North Shore Vancouver Indian residential schools. Bodies were brought in there. Children who had died and issued their fake death certificates issued at St. Paul's Hospital. We've had former employees who described doing that. All of this came out at our first tribunal in June 1998 that I described earlier. St. Paul's Hospital is a killing ground. I remember for many years, for over 30 years, I've worked as a street minister in Vancouver. Time and again, people who were taken off to St. Paul's Hospital were never seen again. Now, also, there's been testimony about children or newborn babies are trafficked through the Catholic foster care system through St. Paul's Hospital. So none of this should surprise us. And in fact, these crimes are, as I mentioned, ongoing. One of the things we're going to hear about in the coming programs over the next few weeks is how the modern-day child trafficking network, especially in the Catholic Church, is very tied into these kinds of hospitals. And in fact, we've had recently sources within the Holy Alliance, which is the Vatican Assassination and Espionage Bureau, who've actually begun to come forward in Europe and describe how these satanic networks, the Ninth Circle, and in British Columbia, the so-called 12 Mile Club, they operate often out of these Catholic churches and Catholic hospitals. So this is a target for the West Coast grand jury investigation, definitely focusing more and more in these places like St. Paul's Hospital and the testimony of brave women like Erica Kelly. In closing, we've got a few more minutes. I want to flag that for folks. Please tune in coming weeks because we're going to be going into details of the findings of the West Coast common law grand jury, its connections with events in Europe. We mentioned this 12 Mile Club. It's named after the 12 Mile territorial limit around Canada. And from former insiders of this network and a former CSIS, that's Canadian Security Intelligence Service agent, who came to our tribunal with this information, the CSIS agent had infiltrated the so-called Piggy's Palace in Coquitlam, where the serial killer Willie Picton operated out of. The Picton brothers were the body disposal crew of a much wider killing network involving a former prime minister, two present serving senators in Canadian government, Catholic bishop, and others who will be named when the grand jury presents its report. These members all part of the 12 Mile Club. Now, how it ties into my story, too, is that the two people presently trying to silence me with a gag order, a cease and desist order, Foster Freed and Phil Spencer, were the two United Church ministers who were engineered by firing and eventual defrocking and blacklisting. These two guys are connected to what was called the West Coast Marine Mission. These are United Church clergy who were going up and down the coast in the Methodist and then United Church mission boat, the Thomas Crosby, and they would stop at these Indian villages, abduct children. These kids were never seen again. They'd be taken to places like the R.W. Large Hospital, where they were sterilized, medically experimented on, the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. These guys are a big part of it, and I didn't know what I was stumbling into, but it was exactly this West Coast child trafficking, child killing network. Now, I've mentioned these guys over the air. I've sent it out in emails. no response, because, of course, they don't want to go into court. We, however, do want to go into court. We're in the court of public opinion. We are naming these crimes because we know that's our best defense. And the fact that they haven't countersued us and are not counting with their own evidence proves they're guilty. Under the law, silence is consent. They're not contesting what we're saying about them. So we're reviving this whole investigation because it's a way to stop the criminals now. It's a way to stop the disappearances of the children today. And this is something we all need to be involved in, of course. Maybe I'm preaching to the choir here, but those of you listening are not just passive listeners. You are people prepared to help in the struggle, and we need you to do that. Tune in every week. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. Go to murderbydecree.com, and especially get on our mailing list so that you can get updates about when the tribunal website will be back up, and the other events being planned in Europe in March and April, where there's a, as I mentioned, a new common law court forming, looking at targeted energy weaponry. A very brave woman, Catherine Horton, who's actually sued in British courts, trying to expose MI5 and their targeting of her with electronic weaponry. This is all documented. She's a particle physicist. She's a scientist with lots of hard evidence of how the energy is used, how implants are put in us, and she's bringing this all out medically and in court. So it's a very exciting development, and we're part of that. She's come to the ITCCS, to the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, to bring a common law court case against these intelligence agencies and the bodies. And it's interesting, she said one of their main bodies doing this, of course, is the Vatican Espionage Service, the oldest corporation in the world responsible for so many of these crimes. So that, if you can take all that in, folks, I know it's usually a very intense thing. I'm reminded in closing of a very fond memory when I was in Dublin in 2010 when we first set up the ITCCS. There was a guy sitting in the crowd. He was a survivor of child rape and torture by a Catholic priest who then became a bishop. His name is Frankie Flanagan. He came up to me after and he said, "Kev, I found out where the bastard lives. I'm going over the wall tonight to get him." And sure enough, he went over the wall. He assaulted this bishop, beat the crap out of him, went to jail for a while, but then the story surfaced and gave a lot of hope and inspiration to people who joined up with the ITCCS. And in very many ways, folks, that's what we've got to do. We don't just talk about these criminals. We go over the wall. We know where they live. We find them. We bring them to justice. We shut them down. That's the only way that Pope Benedict was forced to step down, how the Canadian government and the churches were forced to admit these crimes because of that kind of direct action. They are scared of that direct action. We do not need to be afraid of them. The truth, the higher power, in whatever way you understand that, the people themselves are looking to us and they're on our side. We have the truth and the numbers. We just have to act. That's what this show is all about. I thank you for tuning in loyally again after a number of months being off the air. Again, get our books, Amazon.com, Kevin Annett, thecommonland@gmail.com. Write to us. Get on our mailing list. And most importantly, set up common law action groups and common law assemblies in your neighborhood. And this is our constant work, to be in the communities, working with all of you to set up these direct action bodies that get the results. It's all about reclaiming our power, our mental identity, and then our communities. That's the only way these crimes are going to stop. I want to thank you all for tuning in again. I love you all, especially those of you on the front line with me. And you know who you are. And people like good old Frankie Flanagan, who's still alive and kicking in Ireland. Now, also in closing, just to remind you that we need you to tell us the extent to which you're willing to take action. So when you write to us, say that. What you're willing to do, write to thecommonland@gmail.com. Now, in closing, this song, Bella Ciao, is one of my favorites. It's actually from the time of the Italian resistance against fascism during World War II. It was their theme song, and it's a modern adaptation of that, but it's really about this whole message of reclaiming ourselves and our communities. Take hope, people. The power is in our hand. As Thomas Paine said, we have it within our power to begin the world again. So let us begin again. I thank you. We'll be back here next week. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. Stay strong. Stay clear.